Breaking the Panel is made possible by you and other listeners just as awesome as you are. If you want to support the show and get a little something in return, just go to patreon.com/breakingthepanel, because we do appreciate the help.
Excuse me while I roll up this newspaper. Can you please stop humping your own leg, Chris?
I can't.
That's funny.
It's unbecoming.
These days, the comic book owns pop culture. You'll find it all in the panel of your favorite comic book. Us, we're living the comic's life. We're breaking the panel.
And welcome to Breaking the Panel, where we bring you all the awesome sauce that is comic book. I don't know why I went soccer on you, but I did. I am the Rock Out of Podcasting, Charles McFall, riding along as dependable as he can be, Paul Klotz.
What's that supposed to mean? God damn it, Charles.
What? You're dependable. You're good. You didn't quit on us for six weeks.
So, speaking of,
Chris is taking an extended vacation again today, playing the role of Chris Wisdom as Travis Jones.
All right. To paraphrase one of the greatest entertainers of our generation, finally, the Chris has come back. Breaking the panel.
Oh, my boy, The Rock Johnson. Love him. That was when wrestling was entertaining, when The Rock was there. You know, that was my era of wrestling. Okay.
Wrestling was entertaining?
I didn't say real. I said entertaining, yeah.
No, I'm confused still.
Okay. I got you. I mean, I did grow up, of course, with the Mean Gene Green and the Hulkster and all that jazz in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. When I was little, I liked wrestling.
Yeah, and then I didn't like it again until a friend of mine got me into it. Then I literally randomly won tickets to go see SummerSlam in 96, 98. I don't remember. But I went to go see SummerSlam. And as in The Rock's heyday, and he's just charismatic, and he's awesome to watch. And I got hooked for a very little bit of time, and as soon as he left, the spell is broken. I don't have to watch this crap anymore.
I like seeing pro wrestlers in movies. I don't like seeing pro wrestlers wrestle.
Dudes, I saw Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 Out of the Shadows. I loved every second of it. Finally got to see it. I didn't even get show notes. Chris, you guys took Chris, over the show notes
Chris,
today.
Chris tried to talk, okay, and he hasn't been here, and you just need to let him speak his mind, okay?
I just wanted to acknowledge to all of our wrestling fans that yes, we are aware that Mean Joe Green is a football guy, and Gene Okerlund is the wrestling announcer that Charles was probably fumbling his way through his name.
I don't care.
Of casuals once again.
I don't care. I call Chris, the Hulk the Hulkster. Nobody calls him the Hulkster. I don't care.
You've been gone so long, you forgot that Charles is never right?
No, I know he's not. I just wanted to acknowledge our fans.
Have you gotten a... be caught up on all the episodes that you missed, that you were out on?
Not all of them. I stopped Wonder Woman because I just saw Wonder Woman this weekend, so I didn't.
Yeah. What about last week's with Hammond?
I haven't. Nope.
Oh, I get to correct Klotz, and there was nothing he could say. I got to correct you. It was awesome.
Because you muted his mic?
No, because he said Adam West was the first Batman on screen. I was like, no, he wasn't the first.
Oh, yeah. Charles knew an obscure thing that somebody else
knew. I knew an obscure fact. No, I actually heard that like last year sometime.
Probably on DC on screen.
Oh, it absolutely was DC on screen. But you know,
yeah, exactly.
I memorized my Bible verses like a good Christian. Anyway, you said wrestler Sheamus was in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. But I just wanted to do a quick thing of how much I loved the characters. Everything was, it was my version of the Turtles from the Saturday morning cartoons brought to life perfectly. It was cheesy. It was fun. It was a live action cartoon. And I loved every second of it.
I don't remember the turtles on Saturday morning cartoons being 8 feet tall and damaging Humvees when they, crashed into them.
Chris, but you got to take a crap on everything I love, man. Go back to the desert.
I didn't. Michael Bay did.
Man, I got to tell you.
I love the Bay, man.
This feels good because I don't have to carry the shovel that piles the trash on Charles anymore.
Can we not phrase it like that? I get enough from Dennis about what I shovel. I don't need it. I don't need the ammo for him.
wait, memo pads and pens? You shovel those? I didn't
realize. No, he thinks all I do is shovel sand and snow.
Probably.
Don't I you? Mean,
we, For all we know, you're Batman because you disappeared for 6 weeks and the world hasn't ended yet. So,
yeah. That is it. All right, let's see what these show notes have to offer because you know I had to squeeze my little headline into the end. But what you got, Klotz?
So last week, Chris, you weren't here, so we'll fill you in a little bit. Last week we discussed how Kevin Feige announced. Officially confirmed that Venom was not part of the MCU, and everybody can stop theorizing about that. And Charles, you know, kind of half put his foot in his mouth by trying to say, well, like, yeah, obviously. And I was
No, I didn't put my foot in my mouth. I quoted our own show where we talked about when Sony and Marvel made the deal.
The fact that you haven't been staying on top of it.
That's in your job description.
What's your job description?
To bring the fake news and the love of Michael Bay and make people laugh.
That is entirely accurate. That is literally all of your... That's his whole contract, folks. Like, it's all in there.
It's all in the negotiation, man. I got the easiest end of the job.
So, we talked about that a little bit last week. And Feige confirmed. Except... just a few days ago, in a video interview, Amy Pascal from Sony Pictures is sitting next to Kevin Feige doing press for Spider-Man Homecoming, and she says that Venom is absolutely part of the Spider-Man Homecoming universe, and that you can totally expect to see more done in that regard.
And what did Feige do?
He looked very uncomfortable.
He put sad Affleck to shame.
Yeah. This hit the Marvel subreddit the other day, and I lost it because people's comments were like, they're like, I've never seen somebody look so awkward. Like, just sitting there, having to just listen to her prattle on, because she doesn't know half of what she's actually talking about. And so we're going to have a link to the actual video in the notes because the original link in that Reddit thread actually disappeared because the Twitter post that had it up disappeared because I think Marvel is disappearing that video. But we have a mirror available. But one of the things I wanted to talk about is there was some really interesting speculation in that thread where people were talking about how it really looks like they're trying to subvert their relationship with Marvel now, where like they're like, oh yeah, we're buddies and we're gonna, yeah, Feige, you're running the show, bro, we're with you. And then like as we're getting closer to Homecoming coming out and getting closer to what is presumably going to be a slam dunk, they are waiting to just like stick their flags in the sand and be like, yep, we've been here the whole time, welcome to America, this is our place.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of Casino, and Marvel, Disney Marvel is the Robert De Niro character, and Sony is the Joe Pesci character, mm-hmm. and the De Niro is respected, and he's making a good name for himself, and he's doing what he can to build this business, and here comes little Joe Pesci being an asshole, doing whatever he wants, saying what he wants to who he wants, and he's gonna run out of credit soon, I think.
I did see a great meme that either Tony P. Henderson or our good friend Casey Straws posted. I forget which one of the two, but it was like Feige and Marvel respond to Amy Pascal, and it's just Thor and somebody standing there, and they just bust out laughing, and it made me laugh. So what do we think? Do we think that Feige speaking off turn? Do we think that Sony, Amy Pascal speaking off turn?
This is go ahead, Chris.
I think Amy's speaking out of turn.
I
think they're trying to lend credibility and viability to the extended Spider-Man universe by saying, by using the transitive property.
Yeah.
When the only thing that DC Marvel has to do with is Spider-Man proper. Mm. I mean, you can easily see where the connection could be made. Well, if Spider-Man's in the MCU, then again, by transit property, they have to also exist in the MCU and the Homecoming universe. But that's not how the contracts were written, I'm sure.
what she's essentially establishing here is that Sony sees it as there's a Spider-Man Homecoming universe that overlaps like a Venn diagram with MCU. But she's not saying that Venom is part of the MCU because obviously they haven't inked that deal. But she, yeah, exactly. She's trying to get it, all that credibility to rub off on the rest of the Spider-Verse stuff. I really do think that they're... I speculated in the past. I remember back on From the Helicare, we talked about this a little bit last week too. I speculated that Sony might be looking to cut Sony Pictures off and sell it, shop it someplace else, you know? And then we talked about that last week as well, and we talked about how there was some rumors that they might have been really drumming up Homecoming in order to be, and then Venom, to be the vehicle for that, to be the, hey, look, that we got this hot property. This is the, you know, the cherry on top, if you will, of an established business that might change hands. I now am pretty sure that I was wrong and that they've changed their mind on that because of the potential success of Homecoming. Because it looks like they're ready to dig in and try to make a fight for it.
Well, but there's also this aspect of being nice to somebody, right? So we run with the crew, GSTU. We've built a relationship with each other, right? We've built a family, and outside of that, we have some connections to other people. And I'm not referring to Tony or Casey. We love those guys. And they are great outside the network help whenever we ask, they show up. And it's awesome. But we have a crew, right? And everybody's had a group of friends or some kind of crew they've been with. And then the little guy comes along, right? The little brother, the somebody's like, you guys are doing some cool stuff. And because of who you are, you're nice to them. But because you're nice to them, they're not part of your crew. You're just nice to them. Then all of a sudden they're like, yeah, I'm doing stuff with this crew. And I'm going to be, you know, they're going to Dragon Con and they're going to have panels. I'm going to be there too. That's what it feels like with Sony and Marvel right now is I don't know the full financial deal, but we do know Sony was having a lot of issues. It's not too much of a stretch to say Marvel came and helped them out. Marvel brought their big crew and said, hey, we're going to be nice to you. We'd love some of our properties back. We'd like to work with you best we can. We're going to help you out. And now Sony's going, hey, I'm doing stuff like the MCU, and you're not.
Right. Wow, guys, that was like a 3-minute explanation of what Chris and I already said. Nice.
Yeah, but I threw in voices. You guys didn't use voices.
Yeah, that was real good.
It's like pictures in a book. Words are fine. You need pictures in a book.
Hey, I'm sorry. I would have replied, Paul, but I'm worried. I'm busy typing my apology email to Tony for the Atlanta-based host, referring to him as the help.
No!
Wow,
Chris!
I just don't want it to be awkward next time he's on the show.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah, we're gonna have to get ahead of that.
So obviously, yeah. Dennis, he shovels more than just Noah's hand. Just saying.
Go to the tape; it's there.
All right. So moving on, before we get in even more trouble, there's a snippet in that Reddit thread of an email. And somebody was like, hey, just look at this little snippet from an email about how they were brainstorming ideas for the Spider-Man films. And so we don't have any details as to who wrote this snippet of email. I can't even verify its accuracy. But this sounds absolutely legit. It's an email subject titled Spidey Thought. And it just opens with, hey, Amy, just a couple of rando thoughts from 35,000 feet LAX to JFK. A rising trend we see with millennials are the really extreme forms of experiential exercise, like Tough Mudder, a sort of filthy triathlon, the color run, and even things like hot power yoga, veganism, etc. Millennials will often post NBD on their social media after doing it, as in no big deal, also known as the humble brag. Wondering if Spidey could get into that in some way. He's super athletic, bendy, strong, intense, and it's all NBD to him, of course. Also, EDM, electronic dance music.
I love how he has to explain that.
For millennials. Wondering if there's an EDM angle somewhere with Spidey. His movements are beautiful. Would be awesome with a killer DJ behind it.
Snapchat. The dubstep works so well.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, how do we... this might be where that whole dubstep thing came from.
That's true.
This email could be the impetus for that horrific event.
Dude, Dubstep is the Michael Bay of music, but I like it.
We're not going to talk about dubstep on this show right now. I'm going to finish reading this snippet. Snapchat just launched a story functionality, which is sort of day in the life of me told in a series of Snapchats that expire after 24 hours. It has a very VIP quality about it, since invitation only. Getting invited into Spidey Snapchat circle would be huge and very buzzworthy and cool.
Okay, that actually would be. I'd totally be in Spider-Man Snapchat circle.
Also, on American Hustle, I was thinking, and it may be too late for this, it would be awesome to get all the cool fashion brands to do a huge 70s style collab. Urban Outfitters, Free People, American Apparel, etc. They're sort of leaning 70s already. Macklemore heading it a bit with Thrift Shop, and then the email gets cut off. I don't know where that came from. It looks like maybe they were at one time considering doing 70s era Spider-Man, would be really funny.
Unless he sidetracked, because I don't know. I'm asking, did Sony do American Hustle? Because then that would date the email. That would.
Oh, you know what? That's right. Now I'm reading that and I'm seeing. Okay. The context of that is also about American Hustle. Because I see it. I'm sorry, folks.
No. I mean, it makes sense of what you were going with. And actually, a 70s Spider-Man could be kind of cool.
Well, you know what? That gives us a pretty good indication of around where this email was probably sent, and that was a few years ago. So, there's some temporal context for you folks at home who are keeping track. I included this snippet, even though I can't confirm that it's actually somebody at Sony. I can't confirm it's real or any of that, but I really feel this is legit. Like, this just oozes exactly how they handled the ASM movies to me.
Well, as a guy that may or may not have experience in faking emails from and to corporations, I just want to say that there's no production value in this one, and some people try harder.
Excuse me while I roll up this newspaper. Down! Can you please stop humping your own leg, Chris?
I can't.
That's
I can't.
Funny.
It's unbecoming. Anyways.
October of 2013, Snapchat updates its app to include the option to create Snapchat stories. And this is exactly what it is. So that helps you date this. If this is real, that helps you date the email.
Well, that tells me that this probably came out. This was probably where the dubstep thing in ASM2 came from. Yeah. Also known as Ass to Mouth, the Spider-Man film.
They destroyed Electro, man. That was, and Rhino. Don't give me started on Rhino.
Rhino was supposed to just be a little bit before, because they were doing the Sinister Six movie, so that was supposed to transition directly into an awesome film for him, and it didn't. Because when you character assassinate Electro, that's going to happen.
Yeah, and well, they character assassinated just about everybody in that film.
I actually think the way they handled the Gwen Stacy stuff and Green Goblin was actually fine. It's just that Electro in that film at the same time, you know, that's a film that had everything you needed. You know, it had all the ingredients for the goulash, and then the Electro stuff is the way too much salt that somebody poured in and just ruined the whole pot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you fix Electro in that movie, I don't see why people would be upset with it. Unless you just hate Andrew Garfield, which some people do. But, yeah. Any case, moving on. Just wanted to share that with you folks at home, because it was really interesting. It just happened. It's really funny because we just talked about it. Speaking of other awkward things. Speaking of other awkward handling of Marvel properties by other studios, there's a rumor on the street that Fox is developing a new Fantastic Four film. This is just rumor, unsubstantiated, but you know what?
I saw
Charles doesn't get anything right, so I'm willing to risk it.
You should let me read it then they can blame me.
Go ahead. Yeah, dig in.
So I also saw just this evening a rumor that instead of a film, Fox is working on an kids animated series. So
it could very well be the same project.
It could be, yeah. So basically, Bleeding Cool says that they might be doing another one, despite that it tanked.
Bleeding Cool's editor-in-chief, Rich Johnson, says sources have told him that Fox has got the ball rolling on it. Here's the interesting part. It seems like it might not focus on the actual four. It looks like it's going to be centered around the Richards children, Franklin and Valeria, and that the four characters will appear in it, though.
Which... As to quote the wise Paul Klotz, hard pass.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, to me, it's... I read this. I didn't read this one. I read another source earlier today, and I couldn't get past the why and the how of it, because you've... Now you're asking me to... You're asking me as just general audience to understand the children of the Fantastic Four and where they come from, besides just the fact that, you know, sometimes when a mommy loves a daddy very much, they, you know, make baby... I mean, so...
They make a horrible film.
That... Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's... And again, like, as much as I like the property of Fantastic Four, until you come with something remarkable and complete... A complete package, not just that it looks like characters or that you maybe get some of the characters right, but you have a good story, you have a compelling story that's not over the top, but not too real, I guess, or based too much in the real world. What do we need? Why do we need anything other than The Incredibles? Because Pixar did it right.
Yeah.
A long time ago already.
there's nothing to respond to that. I mean, that's spot on.
Yeah,
I think Fox should just let this one go. Just be like, we can't do it right. We've had a whole bunch of tries, and we just can't do it right.
You know, it's like the person getting married, remarried for the fifth time. Maybe you should try living together for a while. Do something different. Mm. Change it up, because you've proven you can't quite get it to work for you.
See, Feige has said in a couple interviews in recent months here that there's no open animosity between Marvel and Fox, that it's not like that, it's just business, and it's, you know, they're doing their thing, we're doing our thing, you know, no big deal. I think that that is him just trying to be
political.
Yeah. But also, like, he's being kind.
Yeah.
I think the reality is, I think Marvel is not necessarily like lacing the gloves up, but I feel like Fox has had the gloves on for 6 to 7 years, and, you know, they're ready to throw down. Fox does not want to give these properties up. So they're going to keep churning out these complete garbage pile films just to keep the rights.
Well, and it's, oh, go ahead, sir.
I was going to say, them focusing on the kids tells me that they're desperately grasping for something that might take root, you know, that might actually find an audience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they're including the original four in the film anyways means that they're just securing rights to mm-hmm. me. They're doing everything they can to make sure that they don't lose anything. I find that kind of detestable, to be honest, at this point. Like, I really just wish they would engineer a sale, because they could get a pile of money from Marvel to give those mm-hmm. characters back.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah. Then, you know, the film industry is complicated, because having a property like that, being able to make garbage films around it, and then being able to write off all those losses when those films don't do well is actually big buku. You know, it's big money. So,
and, you know, if they would just, I think if they went the Skrull route and brought Uatu the Watcher in, because James Gunn and company already did half the work for him. Mm-hmm. They already got everybody excited because they saw Watchers on the big screen, and now they can have the name in Watchers on their movie.
I mean, Charles got excited.
I know.
And who would?
And it didn't take an explosion.
Yeah. Jesus. Well, there was an explosion in France. Did you hear him on that panel?
Hey, yep.
Oh, like y'all didn't. I'm just saying.
I thought it was great. Yeah. I mean, I applauded, but I didn't, you know, not.
You know what? Honestly, there's no money in honor. And the honorable thing, like you said, would be Fox to go ahead and start packaging a sales deal where you still get rights, you still get paid, and it can go on to be good movies. But there's, if they can just keep it, it keeps Marvel from making movie on something they failed to make money at. I said movie, but I meant money. It keeps Marvel from making money on something that failed to make money at. And I don't know if they made their money back. I haven't gone and looked at the numbers, not from box office, but from DVD or rentals. Or, I mean, people have watched this thing. The contract with, I think, HBO had it for a little while. Then it'll probably go to Netflix or Hulu or somewhere after that. They're making some money on it, and maybe enough to cover the cost of it. And it's almost like the ex-wife, right? I don't want it, but because you want it, you can't have it. Mm-hmm. So...
Oh, absolutely. That's totally what's going on. Though, I don't have an article for it, but you just led me to the point of remembering. I just saw an article go out in the last week or so about the Chinese film-going market. and how a lot of films that flop over here are doing so well in Asia and specifically China that it's making up for how bad it flops in the States and the West. Okay. So we might see more of these not-so-great films because they do well enough overseas. You know what I mean? So what you were just talking about with DVD sales and everything, I don't know if you were just talking North America sales, I don't know that they've recouped their money. But if you include Asia, they probably have made a decent, you know, bank on it.
Are you talking Fantastic
Four
Stick? Right now, worldwide, last numbers on Box Office Mojo have it at shy of $168 million. And it cost $120 to make, and that's just production budget. That doesn't count advertising and all that.
Right. But when you think about residuals,
they've probably made their money. They probably broke even.
They've definitely broke even at least, and they're probably cresting into that, you know, that golden zone where you're getting all.
Now I wonder if when we start seeing a shift like that, if you start seeing reduced showings in America, like not as wide a release, because they'll know how well it's going to do prior to with test audiences and stuff.
Oh, yeah, I mean there's no reason for them to not, you know what I mean? Yeah. To not do that. The other thing is that what the article I saw mentioned that we might see more subtle catering to the Asian market. For example, like this is really funny because of how many times we talked about whitewashing, you know, months ago, but really they're saying they're starting to insert prominent Asian characters for the Asian audience so that or inserting Asian locales so that there's some, you know, relevance there for people to attach to. That's something I'd keep my eye on, because that'll be a real interesting cultural shift to kind of pay attention to and see come to fruition.
Yeah.
But I absolutely think there's some merit in, you know, all of that analysis. That might be a thing. You know, we talk about how bad a film does over here, but the Asian market is very different. And you got to remember that a lot of those people are watching, they're not English first language folks. They're English as a second language, or they're watching a translation. And what is abysmal to us probably seems okay in translation.
Well, I don't know, because when you look at, I get what you're saying, but when you look at pure numbers over there versus theater going people in America, I mean, them doing twice as well in the Asian market. And that's just the foreign market. In the foreign market, they made $111 million, shy of 112. Domestic, it was 56. Mm-hmm. So that's just because you have twice as many people over there that are going to see it initially and never go again.
But you've also got to remember the socioeconomic differences, too.
Oh, that's true, too. But so I think
getting those numbers is still pretty remarkable, because it doesn't cost as much to see a movie in China as it does here.
Right.
You know, at least not if you break it down to raw.
And I gotcha. I'm just saying, you know, 330 million people, of which not everybody's going to see it, versus, you know, a billion plus. Even if the percentages are the, you know what I mean? So.
I was going to make a horrible joke, but I'll let it slide.
Please don't.
No, I'm not this time. Well, moving on to not quite MCU or Fox or anything news, but this I find interesting. Actually, I had to ask Chris, I'm like, from what? Because the headline reads, Daniel Day-Lewis calls it quits. I'm like, okay, last time he worked was like 2012. I mean, I like him. I do. I think he's a great guy as far as an actor goes. I really liked his work. But he tends to take large breaks in between films. So what's the headline here, Klotz? What do we care?
The headline is that he and his management/representation have announced that he is retiring from acting.
And we figured out he's only about 60 years old, so he's still early in his career.
Yep. He has one more film awaiting to release. It's due to come out on Christmas. It's a Paul Thomas Anderson film. It's supposedly about the world of high fashion. He's
in the 1950s. I looked it up for today. Yeah.
Yeah. He said he's going to promote as he normally would. But his representation said that this is a private decision and neither he nor his representatives will make any further comment on the subject.
No, I hope there's not some kind of family tragedy or illness going on, man.
I don't necessarily know that that's the case. He's just somebody who seems very
private.
Private, yes, but also someone who is like, he commits.
Yeah, he's very method. And when he commits to the roles, like I think of My Left Foot, right? That's the one that I usually think of when you talk about the level to which he goes to get into character for a movie. I mean, all of the best things that you could say about Heath Ledger's portrayal of the Joker during The Dark Knight and how into that character he got. And this is what Daniel Day-Lewis does for every character that he plays. It's got to be exhausting, mentally taxing, physically at times, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I feel like Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Tropic Thunder is really Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
If we're being real. And that kind of tells the whole story. But now, the big thing here is I thought this was kind of newsworthy because he's kind of a staple at this point. I mean, he's been acting for four decades. He's been in some great films all the way from, you know, the 80s and 90s up till now. Like you said, Charles, he takes these breaks, but whenever he reappears, I mean, he's the only actor to win three Oscars, for like three best actor Oscars. That's crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's been people who've accumulated multiple Oscars, but like he's one of them for best actor. That's, you know, that's saying something. Apparently he was semi-retired too when he was working as a cobbler, I guess, when Scorsese wanted to do Gangs of New York. And so he approached him and basically begged him to come back. So I found that pretty interesting. But I thought this was kind of noteworthy. I don't know that it's necessarily any personal tragedy. I don't think it's necessarily about that. I think he's just a very, like I said, he's somebody who commits 100%. So I think if he made up his mind, he's prepared to like let his mind be known. You know what I mean? Just kind of slam the door in the face of all of Hollywood and just say, I'm done.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I don't think anybody can ever, if he literally never makes another film after this one that's coming up, nobody can ever say anything bad about his acting career.
Right.
Because he's been one of the best. I mean, you can critique, but like overall as a scope of the whole thing, because I look at somebody like Anthony Hopkins, who's about to be in a steaming pile.
No, he's not.
And I mean, Anthony Hopkins was one of those people that filmgoers used to, you know, mention his name in a hushed whisper of like, oh, he's so good, you know.
Sir,
like,
Anthony Hopkins, thank you.
Sir Anthony Hopkins is exquisite, you know. He's fantastic
and
actor.
He has great choices in films that he's in.
Except he doesn't anymore.
You haven't seen it? Maybe he makes it awesome.
Money.
And, you know, and one of my all-time favorite actors, Robert De Niro, was in Rocky and Bullwinkle. So,
you know, speaking of De Niro, I just saw Dirty Grandpa.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. Is it hilarious?
Oh, man, it's on Hulu, and oh, wow. Yeah. Got to get that money. I mean, it was fun. I laughed. I had a good time, but like, whew. And Aubrey Plaza, oh my God. Like, she committed. It's great. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just say, well, thank you, Mr. Day-Lewis, for your wonderful portrayals of really interesting characters, and please reconsider, but I don't think you will.
And your obvious ability to say no to certain scripts that may or may not cross your desk, unlike some other great actors.
Right.
You haven't seen it, you don't know. It's going to be great.
I was talking about Bobby. It's not always about Michael Bay and his Transformers.
No, here it absolutely is. Every time. All right. So moving on. Another Skynet debacle has happened. Another breakthrough of the hackings of the things that are on the webs.
So Larson Studios broke their silence on some Netflix leaks that went out recently. So basically this studio, it's a sound production studio that got hacked, and all of the projects that they were working on that were available through one machine that apparently was a Windows 7 machine that, like these hackers were apparently going around trying to find, you know, basically rattle the doorknobs wherever they could to find, older OSs that they could just sneak into. And they hit the jackpot with this one because this is a sound studio that does work for Orange is the New Black and films and other TV shows. Like, they work for a lot of prominent studios and production companies. And so this was real hush-hush for a while. When it first went down, it went down around Christmas, I guess. They got the ransom notes, if you will. And they were extorting them. So they were like, hey, we want you to pay. And they were making them pay in Bitcoin. And it's this whole thing. We'll have a link in the show notes. It's also on Variety's website. This is a crazy story. They contacted the FBI right away. They paid like more than $50,000 in extortion money to try to get them to not leak any of the stuff. Like, cause their attitude was, we're a small company, but we have big clients and we owe it to them to try to protect their properties and their product. And so, they were really, jumping on the sword to try to make sure that they could keep this all, under wrap, and they had to just come out and reveal it to the world and tell everybody what happened. It's a really interesting story. So if you're into like cybersecurity and its impact on various aspects of the entertainment industry, people are calling this like the biggest thing since the Sony Pictures hack of 2014. And there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff there. But the takeaway, guys, is update your OS, I guess.
Is this the same group that got the new Pirates movie? Really?
Probably. It's probably where they got it. The group is calling itself the Dark Overlord. Oh, man. So these people.
So they're 13-year-olds, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, these people are brilliant enough to crack operating systems and sneak into people's networks and steal all their data, but they're not crafty enough to come up with a better name.
I heard Stranger Things season 2 is going to be about this. those kids are the Dark Overlord hackers.
It's going to be 10 episodes of them trying to think of their group name.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I was kind of befuddled at the amount. 50,000 is not a lot at all.
Well,
considering how much in fines and penalties if they got caught.
So, well, here's the thing. The article goes into a lot of details about this. They asked for it in Bitcoin. Uh-huh. And so a Bitcoin is going for about $1,000 right now.
Ah, okay.
And so the Larsons actually had a hard time getting enough Bitcoin. Because apparently it's really hard to buy a lot of Bitcoin and send it to somebody real quick. Jill Larson goes into detail saying that she had to wire money to Coinbase, which is an internet bank for Bitcoin transactions, and it set alarm bells off at their regular bank, which urged the company to talk to the FBI again. And they talked to the FBI, and the FBI was like, we encourage you not to talk to extortionists and hackers, but we also acknowledge that you're a business that has responsibilities. So basically, like, it's not illegal for them to, I guess it's not illegal for them to pay the extortion.
No, I don't think it's ever illegal to pay
blackmail
or ransom or anything like that, because you're the victim.
Exactly. So, so they were trying to pay, even though they were in full contact with the FBI. The FBI was aware of what was going on. They were trying to investigate it, track it all down. The other thing, though, is what really came out is that they weren't just extorting this original company that had the data. They were extorting all the studios that produced the original content that was being worked on. So they were going back to Netflix and being like, hey, we want some money from you because we got the next season of Orange is the New Black. And you probably don't want us to put that on in there in that dang old internet. And apparently the buzz started to build up as various studios were getting contacted and threatened and all this stuff. So it's a really interesting story. And
don't you know you only work one grift at a time? What the hell?
Oh no, this is brilliant. They have a very narrow window to grift everybody. I don't want to praise them. I don't.
No.
This will be a really interesting movie or TV show in a few years where we get to see all of this going on. And I hope we get the equivalent of the Silicon Valley,
manipulation of male genital scene. I want the next iteration of that to come in whatever you know, show or film that comes out of this whole hack. But this story is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I don't want to praise them either, but I am interested to see their Q2 and 3 earnings for 2000.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, where can I send some checks to invest?
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. You know, one of the other takeaways here is it's, you know, obviously it's pretty shitty because this is a real good way to kind of like ruin something like Orange is the New Black is a big thing for Netflix. And so if they put it out there months ahead of time, it can really screw with a company like Netflix. You know what I mean? It can really affect their bottom line. I think a lot of people are obviously not going to go download that show per se, because they know they're going to see it on Netflix and they already have an active subscription and they're going to wait for it. But the point is that it takes a lot of wind out of their sails.
Mm-hmm.
Any kind of leaks like this, it always, you know, it can really seriously impact the business's bottom line. So yeah, I don't want to praise it, but it's a really interesting story and it'll be interesting to see what ends up coming out of it going forward. And yeah. Wow. So there you go.
There you go. All right. So we've got a whole lot more coming up next after the break. So you know how this goes. I mean, Chris, you might forget, but what we do is we take a break right here so that maybe we can make a little bit of income so we can keep the lights on, keep you out of the desert for another 5 minutes and keep you
here.
Well,
it hasn't been working, has it?
No, not quite, but we're trying.
Well, neither have you.
We're at least trying to buy you a new shovel. So, all right, stick around after the break. We've got a whole bunch more headlines coming up. And we're back with Chris's take on all kind of stuff right now. I mean, the boys are excited. Klotz is excited Chris is back. That whole first half was him, man. He's like, woo, Chris is back. I got to talk about some stuff. And, you know, Chris is like, woo, I'm back. I got to talk about some stuff. I'm like, can I have like one headline, please? I'd like just one to bring to the table. So they've given me the kids table at the back of the show.
Didn't we give you two opportunities to talk about Transformers? Do you need more than that?
More than meets the eye. Anyway, yeah. So here's the thing. We did cover, while Chris was gone, we did cover that there was a tragedy with Snyder and that Whedon's going to be stepping in to do Justice League, finish the reshoots of Justice League. You know, of course, we talked about Wonder Woman. We're going to hear about that. I saw a headline that really was clickbait about how Whedon's going to totally reshape the DCEU. And then even before you could click on it, there's a little subheadline. It's like, well, this is just some things we think could happen. It's like, you just totally, not that I was going to click on it because I think you're full of crap, but you just totally took the wind out of your sails by going, well, we're making it up, but we wanted you to know before you clicked on our link. That's not how clickbait works. But first off, Chris, you took a picture of what looked like an audience full of angry people staring at you when you went to see Wonder Woman. How'd you love the movie?
It was amazing. Like, this is, I couldn't have asked for more on the third outing for the DCEU. Go figure that when they start doing the Berlantiverse method of heart, humor, and hope, that you get characters that resonate, you get stories that resonate. They had those Zack Snyder visuals, and I'm going to go so far as to say they had better than Zack Snyder's visuals, because Zack Snyder concerns himself with panels. He wants you to be able to look at one frame of film and be like, remember that one is in the comic book? Oh, the geeks are on my side now, right? Yay! Wonder Woman gave us scenes that were beautiful, wonderful vistas. Themyscira, I was amazed from the moment they said go. It was beautifully shot. Patty Jenkins did a wonderful job with this film. Diana, she gave such, Gal Gadot gave such a Starman-esque, performance. Like, that was the first thing that came to mind was Jeff Bridges' Starman and the way he didn't understand Earth so much. So you're really getting an outsider's view of how the world operated and trying to get things explained. So it made it seem a little more absurd when you had to talk about things like war and who benefits and things yeah. like that. It's definitely showing how we try to see the world in black and white, but there's so much gray that we're not comfortable with, I think, as societies. Doesn't matter what side of a battlefield you're on, you're not comfortable with talking about those grays and how the other side might not be completely bad. But you have to get yourself in that frame of mind to go to war with them. You know, there was there were only a couple things that I didn't really like about the movie. The biggest thing was for me was that I liked was the hope that was in there, the heart that was in there. Quest versus destiny, because Diana thought that it was her destiny to do something in a certain way, and things were going to fall in this order, and the quest changed. So it wasn't always about you're preordained to do this in this way. Because if when you lose the forest for the trees, you lose sight of what your end goal is or how to attain it or achieve it, I should say. They're overlapping injustices in the movie. You know, whether it be women's rights or minority issues or just people that were affected by war in a negative way, you know, civilians, things like that. Like they made a point that they weren't just talking about one bad thing in this movie. They were like, hey, everybody suffers and we're going to acknowledge that. And Wonder Woman is here to give all of these disaffected populations hope of some sort to say, hey, I acknowledge you. And this is where I'm here to do what I can to help mankind be better. And that's all I ever wanted from Superman in these movies. Yeah. And I didn't get it. That's all I ever wanted.
For a movie about, I mean, she's not an alien. She's technically a human, just an Amazon created by the gods, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But for a movie about a non-human character, essentially, it is so humanity-oriented and bringing people together in the whole story of that. If we get more of this, you'd be happier with the DCEU, right?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I would hope that that's what I've portrayed every time I've talked about the Snyderverse, is that this is what I feel like is missing, and this is why the Berlanti verse works. The last two episodes of Supergirl in season two, like, that is more Superman than I have seen on screen from Zack Snyder. Like what they captured in Supergirl and what she was doing, that's the Superman I want on the big screen. You know, the things that I didn't like in the movie, there's just two, the lasso fighting, it was, and I don't know if it's because of the light differences and the brightness with the dark tones and that bright lasso, but it was very CW bendy to me. I didn't feel like those effects were that great. And then you could tell that with all of these women that were involved in making the movie, you could tell that it was three dudes that wrote it. Because what was it that distracted Diana more than anything? A baby and ice cream.
Yeah, I forgot about the baby.
Spoilers! I actually still have not seen the film. I've got to go see it.
You do. It's really good. And I haven't really spoiled anything. I'm trying to avoid for anybody that... Because even, you know, I just saw it in week three, and I mean, they're still pumping out numbers. It's insane how well this movie is doing. What, week two was the number... They had the least amount of drop-off for superhero flick, a week two superhero flick ever.
I think that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I mean, the performance it deserves what it's doing in the box office. It really does. I think Patty and company really did a good job.
Yeah, it was phenomenal and clutch. I mean, not throw it in, but you're missing out, man. You really
no. I intend to see it. It's just one of those. When you miss the opening week for something like this, it's like you start looking for people to go see it with you because you want to see it with friends. Or family or whatever. And it's I don't want to just go sit there by myself and be like, yeah, Diana, I'm with you, girl.
Now I'm gonna picture a whole new Klotz when we do these panels about how he sits in a theater. Yeah, Diana.
I talk to the camera. No, I don't. I would literally, I would smash my head into the pavement outside in the parking lot if I ever talked to the screen for a whole movie. I would kill myself. Yes, I would. So
Chris, I imagine you're the one that brought this really interesting article.
Okay, so this article about how Joss Whedon is already shaping the DCEU. And the Nerdist put this out today, and I've been since the word of the reshoots has been coming out, and I've been purposely not listening to DC On Screen, because I'm pretty sure that they're going to take the same tact that they did when they said, Geoff Johns isn't going to be the Kevin Feige of the DCEU. It's just another title. And then I was going to have their apostle on the show with me saying, it's just another title. He's not taking that big of a role. When in actuality, the dude grabbed the DCEU by the horns, starting with Wonder Woman. And that's not to say that Patty wouldn't have done things as a director, but when you have Zack Snyder still as an executive producer, he helped write the script. I'm imagining that there were quite a few things in the script that Jeff had a hand in changing, and I think in tone and direction, or at least suggesting, hey, Patty, if you want to do it differently, I'm here for you.
So you're saying you're headcanoning the fact that Geoff Johns is actually doing something.
No, he is very much so doing something. So Joss Whedon, from the beginning, it was reported, and this was when it was at rumor time from somebody within, you know, Warner Brother Productions, that there were going to be massive reshoots. And of course, we get the rounds of downplay. Oh, there's reshoots for every movie. There are always reshoots for every movie. No one is denying that fact. When you start hearing things like major reshoots, especially right after Suicide Squad, which, there weren't major reshoots, and there's only one version of the movie, and then all of a sudden, when it's all said and done, there's two versions of the movie? That wasn't my movie! What? Yeah. There's where there's smoke, there's fire. And when you're talking about, there's been overhead shots of, the casting area, and the number of trailers for the cast to be in, looks about as large as the same one as the picture that they showed, that aerial view of the Infinity War casting area. So there's quite a few people there involved. Plus, they were showing what people are thinking might be the Hall of Justice. An entire new stage was built to add scenes to this movie. And if it's the Hall of Justice, is that a tonal shift? Because usually you only reference that building. And if you're trying to get back to that lightheartedness of the Super Friends, every time that it's been referenced in, you know,
meanwhile at the Hall of Justice,
exactly, you know, yeah. And you do that for that little nostalgia feel. And, it'd be interesting to see it in the movie. I think it's a little too early, but, unless it's at the end of the movie or something.
I want this. What do they call the space station? I know I'm just going to cut to the chase. I don't remember the stupid name. What do they call
Watchtower?
Watchtower.
The Watchtower.
That's what I prefer, honestly, is the Watchtower version.
And I don't have a problem with the Watchtower. And actually, I like the way they did that in Young Justice, where they worked in concert.
All
of Justice was the public face of the Justice League, and then you transport to the Watchtower. But you also have Geoff Johns and... I lost the... John Berg recently were interviewed, and they talking about Wonder Woman. And I think that the success of Wonder Woman has eased up the people that were possibly a little more against Zack Snyder's tone and direction of the DCEU. It's emboldening them. So the quote that comes out is there are lessons to come from every movie. You would be silly not to analyze how a movie was received. What went right and what went wrong on the making of movie. On Suicide Squad, the movie did incredibly well commercially. It didn't work narratively. You had some great casting and some great characterizations, but where the story fell down was on narrative, on plot. We could do better. Batman vs. Superman was tonally dark. People didn't respond to that. And, I mean, that's not entirely true. I responded quite vehemently.
I responded quite positively.
So... other thing that goes along with that before you go any farther that jumps out to me here is in this article they mentioned that composer Junkie XL has been replaced by Danny Elfman.
Yep. I was going to hit that.
Yeah. Talk about tonal shift. Because I remember when BVS hit, one of the big threads on Reddit that I saw, people were talking about Junkie's, you know, soundtrack, his score. And people were like, you know, he's a talented guy, but like, it doesn't fit. You know, it's not right for what they're trying to do with a comic film. And I kind of agreed with that because it's just very, it's very harsh and kind of in your face. You know what I mean? Mm. There's not a lot of elegance to how it's being handled. You know what I mean? It's more of a blunt instrument. But yeah, Chris, by the way, by all means, go ahead.
That was going to be my next point is, and that's incredibly big news. And you know, second, Danny has always been second to me, second only to John Williams for me. And that's one of those things, you know, I was sitting with my son this last weekend when I got home watching Superman the movie, and he has not seen Superman the movie yet. And as soon as the music hit, he knew what that was because that's the music that they use for Superman in Lego Dimensions. Mm-hmm. Because that's the music they use for Superman in a lot of stuff. And because that is how you have heroic music that symbolizes. I mean, it's so light and full of hope and wonder. And Danny too. I mean, when you look at Batman the Animated Series and Justice League and all these things that you can attribute to Danny Elfman scoring, let alone movies that he's done, they just have a way of not being so harsh. I don't know if that's the right word because I don't necessarily have a problem with hard rock or harder forms of music, but I think there's a time and a place, and a Superman movie is not that place. A Batman movie, not necessarily that place. For the Joker when he's on screen, possibly. I could see that, you know, but not to score an entire movie centered around those two heroes. I think, you know, and you can very easily see where that's some Jeff and Joss Whedon influence on Justice League. And that's a huge change when you're changing score of movie or the person that's scoring it. That's big. So whatever it says in your Bible, Charles, there are big things happening in the DCEU. And
well, I've also kind of refrained from getting other people's opinions. One, because so much on the internet, I've talked about this a few times on the show, but it's just so many times we do allow other people to help form our opinions versus just experiencing something. I'm kind of getting burned out on that. But two, I love Joss Whedon. I do. But I also really enjoyed Snyder's vision for where the DCU was going. I know you didn't. In fact, I shared an article with you. I don't know if it helped influence you or not, but talking about how DCEU was showing the weight of the death and destruction that he brought in Man of Steel and everything. I mean, just as a human part of him. I mean, we know he's not human, but he's raised human. So the human part of him struggling with all the lives that were lost that he could not save, the fact that he had to kill his fellow Kryptonian, you know, all this other stuff, it's weighing on, and you see that play out through BVS. I thought that was an interesting take. Snyder says that's exactly what he was going for. I've enjoyed that. I knew when they were courting Whedon to do a film, and the rumor was it the Batgirl? Yeah, the Batgirl film.
He's doing the Batgirl film, but he put it on hold for this.
Okay, well, that makes sense that he put it on hold. I mean, this is an emergency. This is something that takes priority and needs to happen. But the second that unfortunate suicide happened in Snyder's family, and Whedon, of course, was the first person you tap for this kind of takeover. Because, I mean, the films, what would you say in a reshoot? It's 80, 90% done, you know? Well, technically, it's 100% done, but then they're going and fixing some things. So whatever you want to say, it's mostly done. It's not like beginning. It's not pre-production. It's Snyder has been guiding this thing the whole time. And the second they announced Whedon, I was like, shit. Because everybody who hated Snyder stuff, Whedon saved the movie. And the reality is we don't know. We don't know how much Whedon is going to do, what he's going to change, how much. We talked about this, I think, last week, Klotz, a little bit. About, or 2 weeks ago, whenever we talked about it, we talked about how Whedon and Snyder are probably in communication with each other quite often, if not every day, on the vision, on reshoots and whatnot.
I would disagree with that. That was the whole point of what Zach was saying, is that
he needs to be able to step away and be clear.
He needs to, yeah.
Right. I don't know, maybe. I don't think... Somebody is a creator. I would have a hard time seeing a creator fully wash their hands of their baby. But in this kind of situation with the family, maybe so. But my point is, bringing in another person will affect change just naturally, right? Because they're two different people. They're going to do it different ways. But I just am poised for, if this movie was good, everybody's going to say Whedon saved the day. And the reality is maybe they will come out and tell us. Maybe Snyder will come out and say, oh yeah, he changed this and this and this. The audience liked it. Maybe we'll get that. But going into it, we're not getting it. And it just kind of, can we just not watch a movie and see what it does on its own?
Okay. Well, here's the thing though, Charles, I'm going to challenge you on this.
Okay.
All right. We're going to duke it out. He's done two other DCEU films that have bombed, not necessarily financially, but critically have just bombed. Like, the collective perception of those two films is that they weren't great, that they had cool moments, you know, and they're worth watching to see what's going to happen, but that people are, as a whole, largely displeased.
I think it was a divisive film. I definitely think there's either love it or you hate it.
I'm going back to Man of Steel, too. I very rarely hear positive praise for Man of Steel.
I do. But I mean, I listen to things like DC on Screen, and I like the film, so maybe because I like it, I attract more of people who praise it. I'm not saying it's widely praised. I think it was divisive as well. But box office money-wise, it was not a bomb. It didn't crap out. I mean, it's definitely better than Fantastic Four.
I
will agree both these films are divisive. Either you like it or you hate it, and it was not widely loved. Like Wonder Woman has been widely loved, Avengers movies widely loved, but even you get down to talking about Iron Man 2, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I can say it was the weakest of the three films, but I enjoyed it. But there are definitely Marvel people who said That movie didn't exist. Yeah, well, it does, and it was good.
Right.
Enough.
But what I'm saying here is, Snyder did two DCEU films that were critically bombed and have mixed, at best, feedback from the community, from the comic fan community. Whedon did the Avengers film two Avengers films. The first one being widely praised.
Right, like, and the second one we all enjoyed it, but the second one going, not as much.
But my point is, his failure with that second film doesn't drop down to the level of success that Snyder had with either of his DCEU films. I'm saying that the gap is so wide between how good Joss Whedon has been so far with comic films and how not good Snyder has been so far. Do you get what I'm saying? Like,
Just to clarify, it does sound like you're going to fall on the side of, if it's a good film, it was Whedon that did it.
I'm going to, yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. And that's fine.
You don't have to apologize.
I think you'll be able to see. That's where the problems are going to come from in that movie. I don't know that it's going to feel as disjointed as Suicide Squad when you could tell David Ayer versus studio, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's that blatant in the differences. Mm-hmm. When you can see when Joss's hand is there versus where Zack's hand is.
Now, maybe. Also keep in mind, Joss Whedon has screwed this up before. Alien Resurrection is not a great film. And he wrote that script. Mm-hmm. And people have kind of condemned him for butchering the characterization of Ellen Ripley in particular. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's a learning experience. That was 20 years ago. I feel like Whedon knows now how not to character assassinate, which is the big mistake that Snyder was making. I mean, everybody that I talk to, even if they like BVS, they'll admit that the Superman doesn't feel quite right, and the Batman is a little too vigilante, like hyper-vigilante, and not, you know, stoic hero enough. You know what I mean? There's a difference.
And I do understand what you're saying, but I always felt like, and we talked about this on the panel, I felt like that, like when you relaunch a book, or the New 52 versus Rebirth versus anything before all that, that it's that artist or that writer's take on the characters, and that's kind of what I felt like was going. And I followed the path personally that it felt like Snyder was laying down of why Batman was the way he was and why Superman was the way he was. It wasn't the film that most fans wanted, without a doubt. This is not a Transformers argument. This is just a matter of I can agree with what you're saying, and I know the world is going to be with you to say if this movie is better than Wonder Woman, then it's going to be Whedon. And I'm saying I personally think it's still a mixture of the two. It's definitely not one or the other. It's to me, it's still a mixture of the two together.
Oh yeah, because I mean, it would be unfair to say that, you know, well, because I mean that's when we did the BVS panel, I even said that I didn't hate BVS, but I did see flaws. You know what I mean? I enjoyed parts of it, and I can even enjoy a dark comic film. I just don't know that the build-up film right before Justice League was the one. You know what I mean? I think that was a mistake. Now, I'm going to present another idea here. So, and stay with me here.
Okay.
What if I present to you the fact that people, like Chris in particular, is a really good example of this. People look at a character like Bruce Wayne / Batman or Clark Kent / Superman, and due to the way that those characters have been built up over the years, there's a certain personality that you expect, right?
I see, yeah.
So what if the best storytellers are the people who borrow that character and then find a way to tell really great stories without changing who that character is?
That is true, yes.
You know what I mean? Like, because yes. I'm thinking about like some of the best Marvel runs, some of the best DC runs. They're people who really got the essence of a character or even a group of characters, and they take them and they create really compelling stories without trying to change who the characters themselves are. You know what I mean? They mm-hmm. build a tapestry, including those characters that we have a relationship with, you know what I mean? And that's what makes it really fulfilling and really compelling storytelling is when you do that, when you see the best of the characters that you love, and then you get to see them run through a situation where you get to see maybe a different side of them that you never got to see on the page or on film before, but now, you know what I mean? That's what I'm saying is like, and I think that's something that Whedon did really well with Avengers, right? He took those characters and he nailed the characters, and ultimately the plot of Avengers didn't matter as much. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It still was a cool story. It was a good, you know, coming together story, and the villains were generic, but ultimately, well, I mean, obviously Loki wasn't generic, but like the Chitauri were like pretty, we can just murder these guys because nobody cares about them because they're aliens kind of thing. Which was a big difference totally from the DCEU, who's like, we're just going to kill people. We're going to let the aliens murder tons of people. And then we're going to let the alien who never kills anyone kill one of his own.
It's still the human being's fault. If they'd only known the safe word with Martha, none of them would have died.
Oh, my God.
None of them would have died.
I think that Martha scene will go down in history as
it's
perplexing choices ever.
Between that and episode 3 and Vader going, no!
Oh, that's a fictional fight that we need to see happen. Which one's worse, the no words or the Martha words?
So I want to go back to a little bit, like, Charles, if you can acknowledge that these two movies, BVS and Man of Steel, were very divisive. Okay. If you can acknowledge that from the beginning, and then let's talk about Superman 78 and our newest entry, Wonder Woman, objectively good movies. There's a problem there with the other two that we have accepted as supposedly good. To me, honestly, what I feel like Man of Steel and Batman v Superman benefited from was the same thing that the X-Men benefited from when they first came out. We hadn't seen the X-Men on film before. We've been wanting it. And the last two Superman movies we got, Superman 4 and Superman Returns, we were just hungry for something different, something better. This is what we got. And so I probably for the next 5 or 10 years, I'm going to be hearing about how good these movies are. And then the Snyderverse is going to pass and I'm going to get a real Superman movie. And people are going to be like, oh, you know what? Those movies don't hold up. They don't hold up at all. That is not what Superman should be.
I'm with you. I feel like Justice League has a potential to do that. Justice League is the opportunity to save what's going on right now.
I will fully agree with that. Absolutely, that statement.
All right. Affleck as Batman is awesome casting.
Mm-hmm.
He's really got, like, I like Christian Bale as Batman, but that was a certain Batman, you know what I mean? And I'll always love that. But this was a new Batman that I liked. I like this, like, just different take on Batman. I like my Boston Batman, I guess. and I
smart.
Yeah. I like Henry Cavill as Superman. Mm-hmm. I just want it to be written well for him so that he can, because he can act. I've seen him in other films. I know he can act. And I think he looks the part and he's got the chops, man. You know, so we've got the ingredients. It's that goulash again, man. It's, but you got to keep that edgy salt out of there and let these characters really shine. Like, the big thing for me is Batman has, even when they explore, like, alternate timeline, dark versions of Batman, ultimately the redemption part is always that the Batman realizes who he really is, and he's the eternal optimist that he always expects people to, you know, turn bad or betray, and he has a contingency, but he never gives up the hope, you know what I mean, that they can be saved. I mean, that's the one thing that Killing Joke actually nailed, despite that horrific opening. You know, it did capture that fact that in the end of the Killing Joke animated thing, I call it a thing because it's hard to call it.
No,
a
I understand. I did not like it.
He's sitting there with his mortal enemy, and he's still entertaining the idea that there's either a way that he can understand him better, or that, you know, that he might be redeemed. You know what I mean? Otherwise, he wouldn't just stand there and suffer. The fool. He literally suffers the greatest of fools. You know what I mean? And that wasn't present in the storytelling of BVS. That wasn't the Batman we were seeing.
Right, but I would make the argument that the Batman we're seeing is the pre-redemption one. And I think we're about to see the redemptive Batman.
And I don't... Like, I've heard that, and I've heard, you know, this is a Batman that's been, you know, fighting crime for years and blah, blah, and I understand that, but as the average moviegoer, why are you giving me that Batman? Like, I'm not saying you have to give me the brand new Batman and let me see him coming up, but giving me a Batman that's supposedly, what's the age difference between Cavill and Ben Affleck? You know, so Superman hasn't been around for very long, basically 3 days, but Batman's been around for years doing this, and he's at the end of his rope with how to deal with these criminals. I don't feel like that part of the Batman was earned at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, the other part of this is that if you look at a timeline of where that Batman should fit, doesn't that Batman seem better after Justice League? Like, shouldn't we have the hopeful, optimistic Batman that builds the Justice League, and then for some whatever reason the Justice League falls apart later on, and mm-hmm. then we get the jaded, worn-down, cynical Batman?
Yeah, Dark Knight Returns Batman should not be the first Batman. That's not the lead-off Batman.
I also think that was a stylistic mistake to follow a trilogy like that, that it was the Dark Knight trilogy, you know, really. It was meant to be the edgy, the darker, you know, the conflicted Batman. I think it was a tonal mistake to just follow that up again and be like, oh, more of the same. Mm-hmm. And then try to paint that same brush onto Superman at the same time. But yeah, no, maybe. We could go on and on about this, but it'll be really interesting to see what this film does, because I think this is going to put a lot of asses in seats, man. Oh. Like, this conversation we just had is going to be, this conversation is happening everywhere. You know what I mean? People are talking about this. People are like, oh, Joss Whedon is going to do this? He going to fix the DCEU?
And Charles, to put your mind at ease, I won't give Joss any more credit than I'm going to give Jeff. Because to me, that is the impetus for change in the DCEU. It's great to have Joss on board. But this is a Geoff Johns move.
Well, because ultimately Geoff Johns isn't a filmmaker. Joss Whedon is.
Yes. So,
but Geoff Johns is a storyteller.
Yep. And he can see his vision being followed through by Joss Whedon.
And I feel like that's what we really need is a great collaboration between the master storyteller and the master filmmaker.
And I will say this, if in the distant future, right, because sometimes things happen, memoirs come out or you know, we're another 10 years down the road or at the 10-year mark for the DCEU, and maybe still Geoff Johns or whoever is the mouthpiece or the head of all of this, right? They'll come out and say, well, you know, back when we started, we made a few missteps, and, you know, Snyder was great, but he didn't quite go where we wanted to, and we happened to get it right here, blah, blah, blah. I still will stand by. I liked Man of Steel and BVS.
Oh, I don't, yeah.
But I can see, I mean, I was blown away when I watched that Marvel documentary on how they took a chance with Iron Man, and literally I'm screaming going, took a chance? You got the two best people you could get for it. I just blanked on both their names, but the director and Tony Stark, who work well together. And I was like, but watching it from a studio standpoint, from a company standpoint, they were on thin ice. They had no idea what was going to happen, if it was going to work. And they took a huge chance. And then they took a huge chance with the Hulk, and it was a misstep. And I will say, as much as I do like that standalone Hulk, it is a little bit of a misstep. I still enjoy it. And that, you know, this is where we're at, wrap it up. Sometimes we can separate these discussions from the production and the movie value and the storytelling from our personal enjoyment. And I wanted our audience to hear that is even if 10 years from now, you guys are 1,000% right. And I'm not saying you're wrong. It won't change how I approach the films going into it. Now, Wisdom, did we cover what they learned in that conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're good there. So we are down to my headline, which is
So join us next week, folks, on another exciting panel.
You're fired. Oh, man. So this one.
It feels good to fire Chris again.
Right to his face. I mean, we fired him a few times while he's gone, but, you know, it didn't take because he wasn't here to hear it. Warner Brothers film Chief opened R-rated DC comic movies. And we talked about this when Deadpool just made the biggest splash that only Deadpool can make anyway. Everybody's going to try to do this. And it's Toby Emmerich, who is president and CCO, Chief Content Officer of Warner Brothers Picture, isn't ruling it out. He admires that recent R-rated superhero films like Deadpool and Logan see the ratings a possible way of differentiating DC movies from the family-friendly fare of Marvel Studios. That alone, I mean, if you want to say DC is dark and Marvel's family-friendly, that's a big enough distinction. Anyway, but he says, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't at some point make an R-rated DC movie. And they reference, of course, Batman the Killing Joke, which it's not really... I mean, I guess technically it's a DC movie, but that was a weird venture.
The Killing Joke was almost shot for shot a lift from the page.
Yeah.
When they got into the actual Killing Joke proper.
Right.
So that's nobody should be patting each other on the back for that. That story was written decades ago. All you did was transplant from one medium to the other.
And you threw some things on top of it that.
Well, that was
weird.
Yeah, with that intro with the Batgirl side story that felt
the entire Batgirl side story was unnecessary.
It was really tonally off. Like, having them have casual hookup, it was a huge tonal mistake.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It undermines everything that you try to build later on, especially, you know. Yeah, so I mean that was a whole thing. I mean, because they did the whole Oracle story in there too, and it's like you undermined a lot of that by. That was rough. I've seen some really great critique on that film, but one YouTuber I saw, he mentioned the fact that it's so faithful to the page almost hurts it in a way, because then you can't really praise it, like I just said, you know?
Right.
Because it's not, all it is a transplant. It's not, you know, you didn't make anything really new. I really feel like the R-rated film ship has sailed on them. Suicide Squad was that opportunity.
Yeah.
They botched that up.
Yes. We were calling for it as fans in general, as a community, but at the same time, we're like, well, you can't do it now because then you're just copying Deadpool, which honestly sometimes who cares? Yeah, you might be copying Deadpool, but it could have greatly improved the film. Mm-hmm. We don't know. I mean, honestly, I'm looking at this like Batman could go R-rated. No, why? Unless the bad guy is extra bad and the bad guy does all the R-rated stuff, fine. But otherwise, why? It's not going to help Batman. I don't want to hear Superman drop an F-bomb for any reason. Yeah. I mean, it just, no. But yeah, Suicide Squad 2 would be great. I mean, R-rated. If I hear it's R-rated, that's a step in the right direction is what I'm trying to say. They even reference Gotham City Siren spinoff, which to me, that's bad guy films can go already. Now, Logan is a hero, but he's kind of an anti-hero because he rips people's limbs off on purpose and he gets pissed off. And I even said on the panel, I watched it again with the family the other night and I still was giggling like a little schoolgirl going, Berserker, Berserker, we finally got Berserker. You know, and that's in the opening scenes of the film. So,
yeah,
it's not about the R rating. I'm glad that they're open to it, but it's not. I mean, you shouldn't have been close to it in the first place, moron. As a creator, go where the creator wants to go and what he's going to treat the property, because it comes down to what we keep saying about these films. It's about the fan service and it's about the content. And I'm losing the phrase I'm looking for, where you love the property and you treat the property right. Like Deadpool. Yeah, maybe respect. There's a phrase I know that would fit perfectly. I'm losing it. But yeah, Deadpool, I think, worked because Ryan Reynolds loved the character and treated it like it should be treated.
Pretty much everybody who had creative say in the development of that film were staunchly dedicated to doing it the right way. Mm-hmm. And that was vitally important. You know, I don't want to like rehash the whole conversation we just had about Snyder's films, but I think one of the issues that you run into with somebody like Snyder, we've seen enough of his films now that we know that he likes to do movies a certain way.
Yes.
And that's been demonstrated by the DCEU films, because they're not different from Watchmen. They're not different from, you know, Sucker Punch and so on.
He has a style about him for sure. Right. Absolutely.
Now, Deadpool was an example of it being honest in what it was, but it wasn't trying to play to that, you know what I mean, unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, no, you gotta go where the tone is supposed to go. You know, like, you wouldn't do an R-rated Wonder Woman film unless they had decided to do this film like super, like, accurate World War One. Now, I haven't seen the film yet.
Yeah, if you went Saving Private Ryan on it, right?
Right, yeah. If you wanted to do, like, a Saving Private Ryan with her in the trenches with them, you know what I mean? Like, and really, yeah, that would be
you
a really
see heads explode stuff, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That would be an interesting decision. I don't know that it would be successful, but I would be like, wow, that was, you guys have some balls going that direction. But yeah, like, I'm still staring at this Nerdist article where it's got the group shot of all of them in the Justice League, and I can't pull any of the main six characters here and say that they should have an R-rated film. Mm-hmm. Doesn't fit Flash, doesn't fit Cyborg, doesn't fit Supes, Batman, Wonder Woman, or Aquaman. None of that would make sense. Now, if Aquaman was Namor, absolutely do an R. No, I'm kidding.
No, but there, you're right. A Namor film should be R-rated because that dude is dark and he don't care.
Yeah, I mean, he is not Aquaman.
No.
Absolutely. But yeah, no, that's the thing, is it's I was like, almost for a second there, I was going to be like, unless you made a Cyborg film that like tried to play to a certain audience, and I was like, that would just be insulting, and I hope they never do that.
I just pictured, okay, I'm going to knock my own Transformers films, but the I think it was the second Transformer film where they had the two urban cars that weren't anything to do with any of the stories ever. That's what I pictured.
Out of the movie because of them.
And I will admit that I saw those characters like, what are you doing?
I never walk out of movies, by the way. Like, never.
I don't either.
I've sat through some of the worst movies that looked good at, you know, in trailers, and been like, well, you know, I paid my X amount of dollars. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to see it. That film, I was so mad at those bots, those two twins.
Yeah, but that's what I pictured when you said Cyborg already felt like,
That's the definition of tone deaf. Like, they're like, oh, yeah, let's get the Yin-Yang twins to voice a couple of twin robots because, you know, they're popular right now. It's like, dude, no.
Yeah.
I walked out on Meet Joe Black.
You're an idiot.
Well, because that's not why I was there. Episode one trailer, man. I didn't care what movie that was in front of. I wasn't staying for it. I was there for 3 minutes of hadn't seen this on the big screen in 20 years.
Oh, man.
That's funny.
So as far as the R rating thing, to me, this is where it's going to get difficult for Jeff, because this is going to be studio versus creator on whether or not they want to go R rating, because you don't have to go R rating with any DC property. Some of them could they maybe spread their wings a little bit more? Possibly, but I can't think of a DC property that has to be an R. There are definitely properties that would benefit from an R and could work just fine in an R, but I can't think of any that have to have an R. And
right
on from the studio side Lobo. Of things, I don't know why you would, but you can be PG-13 with Lobo. There's so
true.
Much PG-13, yeah,
true.
Because the problem is once you start exploring that R rating, you're starting to cut segments off of your viewing audience, and that equals dollars. That's
man, we're out of time.
Suicide Squad was really the film that should have been an R rating.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. If they do a Harley Quinn solo film, now if they do Sirens, maybe. But then I just feel like if they do the Gotham City Sirens, young women, well, just women in general, are going to want to rally behind that and support it, and they're going to want to go. And if you do it as R, you're going to make it really difficult for, you know, your younger set to try to get out to see it and support it. And so I feel like that would be like a Ghostbusters issue, you know what I mean? Where like if it failed because it was an R rating, people would be like, oh, well, it's because nobody cares about women, you know what I mean? And that wouldn't necessarily be why it failed. So that would be a big mistake, I think. But if you were to do a Harley Quinn film by herself, mm-hmm. and she was to get real dirty, or if you were to do like Joker and Harley Quinn in a film together, like a buddy, like a Bonnie and Clyde type thing, which I think would be, well, I guess we kind of got half of that with Suicide Squad.
Oh, we got part of that. Yeah.
That was half the movie we didn't see, that they apparently shot. If they were to do something like that, I would be down, like an R rated Bonnie and Clyde type thing with those two. And they're just like, you know, going on a tear and, you know, but with good, obviously good motivation and everything.
Oh man. Now I didn't really care for this film. Oh crap. It 90s, Julia,
True Romance.
That, was it True Romance?
Or not True Romance. No, Natural Born Killers.
I'm thinking, yes. Natural Born Killers, which
yeah.
was,
yeah.
had good moments, yes. but was a weird film, but yeah.
No, that's what that movie, yeah, that's what I thought when I first saw Suicide Squad, is that's what that should have been. And they kind of played it a little bit, and I thought that's where they drew inspiration from, was Natural Born Killers. But that's what a Joker Harley Quinn movie should be.
Yes.
My problem, and I don't have a problem with violence. I don't have a problem with gore. I out of anybody that I know would have the least amount of problem with cussing, but I guess to me, that's how you get that R rating easy. So if it's just because they're going to throw in a couple F-bombs or a little more blood splatter than you would get away with in a PG-13 movie, that's my thing. I don't want it to be an easy R. I don't want, not necessarily to be a hard R, but I don't want it to be an R just because they had a good PG-13 property that they just needed to throw an extra F in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to see Joker and Harley Quinn R film where it's R because of what they do, not because of what they
For
say.
For content, mm-hmm. yeah.
That's what I mean. Like I want to see the savagery. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like the cold, you know, the disconnected actions of the Joker. And I want to see the conflict. I mean, we saw a little bit of this, a little tiny hint of this in Suicide Squad, because there is a story there about how Harley isn't 100% down with everything that Joker wants to do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because she does have a conscience, but she loves him so much that she throws it aside all the time. And I want to see them explore that, a Sid and Nancy type thing, you know what I mean? Like just two people just destroying themselves and each other, because that's, you know, because it all revolves around the Joker's madness, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I want to see. That would be a hell of a film, you know what I mean?
But I just don't know that that's a film that DCEU is ready to make, and I don't know that it's the right time for that kind of film.
You know, and I guess because I think of, like, say, Apollo and Midnighter. To me, if you're gonna do them on the screen, that almost has to be an R. But the problem with that is those aren't restricted comics. You know what I mean? You can sell those to a kid. Mm-hmm. So if you can get by it in a medium where you can sell it to kids, you don't necessarily have to make that an R-rated movie. And that's not to say that kids don't go to R-rated movies. I'm not so naive as to think that. But I just, when you start looking at things from the studio perspective, especially with this DCEU, until you start making money hand over fist on these movies, because in that quote, I found it interesting that when they talked about the movie that worked incredibly well commercially, they attributed that to Suicide Squad and not BVS. Mm-hmm. Because they're not making the money off these movies that they know they should have. It should have been a slam dunk billion.
Well, part of that was it didn't BVS get banned from... No, Suicide Squad got banned from China, but not BVS? I can't remember.
Not BVS. And yeah. Was it Suicide Squad? I thought Suicide Squad was good. It was Deadpool that got banned in China.
I know Deadpool got banned. I know they tried to change the title of Suicide Squad to get it into China, but I think the last thing I heard was it didn't make it.
I could see them banning Suicide Squad because China's laws for media has a lot of issues over spiritual stuff like spirits and dead people and stuff like that. They have a lot of traditions that, you know, they don't really want to explore that in their films.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the regime says. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, it looks like from that Google search, it looks like they banned it.
Yeah, because if you think about the whole Enchantress aspect of that story...
It's very spiritual, that, yeah.
Yeah, that is all stuff that is red flags for the China market, so...
They did change the title to try to get it, but yeah, I think you're right, Klaus. I think it was the spiritual aspect that got them. Well, you know, where we go for all our spirituality in the Giant Size Team Up Network is Botched, a D&D podcast. When you're missing your Jesus... Go check out that podcast because it will get you right with the Lord. Let me tell you what. I do like to plug a show on our network at the end of every episode, and that is ours this week is Botched, a D&D podcast. I know it is R-rated, guys. You go listen to that on your own dime, man. It's your own risk. I love it. Ever since Chris is like, you gotta listen to this. I'm like, I don't care about D&D. I've never played D&D in my life. I don't care. And you're like, no, you gotta listen to this. And he was right. It's amazing. The comedy timing, the storytelling, the one-liners is all good. Very hard R, and you can check them out live at Dragon Con coming up first weekend in September. I think it's August 31st to September 3rd, if I remember correctly. It could be September 1st to September 4th, but it's that Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, first weekend, Labor Day weekend in September. So check them out live there, and we're going to be live as well at Dragon Con. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And anything else before we get out of here, gentlemen? Nope. All right, cool. You are awesome. So, email us, btp@giantsizeteamup.com, if you feel like it. You can go to Breaking the Panel, giantsizeteamup.com/Breaking the Panel, and leave us a SpeakPipe message. We're on Facebook as Breaking the Panel and Twitter's @PanelBreakers. Tune in next week to hear Chris say...
Why didn't Wonder Woman tell Antiope as you wish?
Nice deep cut.
Breaking the Panel is the flagship podcast on the Giant Size Team Up Network. You can support the show at patreon.com/breakingthepanel, and you'll find more of our amazing podcasts at giantsizeteamup.com.